Today's Teisho will be on a case from a collection of koans known as the True Dharma Eye. He's assembled by a teacher named Da Hui. And the koan is very simple. It goes like this. The East Mountain walks on water. Let me just read a little bit about the person who was responsible for this koan being given to us. His name was Da Hui, and he was born in Anhui province in the 9th century in China. Following the tradition of the day, he, after deciding to become a Chan, a Zen practitioner, Zen monk, he wandered from community to community, trying to find a teacher with whom he had, you could say, karmic compatibility. So I've mentioned before that in China at one time, during the Tang Dynasty in particular, many, many people believed that the most important thing in life was enlightenment. In other words, if you would, if you had a microphone in the 9th century and you walked down the street in Anhui province, in a town in Anhui province, and you said, what do you think is the most important thing? Lots of people would have said enlightenment. And as a result of that, people built many training centers, many places for men and women to go and practice Chan or Zen. And they were quite numerous all over China. And it was possible for a person to simply decide that he or she was going to wake up, and you could present yourself at one of these temples. And lots of people lived their whole lives in the public temple system. In the United States today, we have a public school system. So when you're a school-age child, you can present yourself at a school in the district where you live, and they'll admit you to the school. And when you get through the 12th grade, if your grades are at a certain standard, you can present yourself to a public university in the state of New Jersey, and you will be accepted. So we've spent a lot of money in our state on public education. And in fact, you know, you might not realize it, but New Jersey is one of the best educated. You wouldn't guess, actually, driving your car around, New Jersey is one of the best educated states in the United States. It's like number one or number two. Isn't that? You would just never guess, but it's the truth. And that's because, believe it or not, we have spent a lot of money on education. And I think that's wonderful. And so we have good universities in the state of New Jersey. We have a lot of very good public schools. And we have community colleges or county colleges, and we have state colleges. So we believe in education. We think it's important. We put a lot of our resources there. And the people in China at this time really believed in enlightenment. And they actually spent a lot of money and went to a lot of trouble to make it possible for people to practice. So, you know, rather different culture than ours. Probably if you walk down a street today in New Jersey and you said, what's the most important thing in our culture? Most people would say money. whenever I'm asked to give guest lectures, I always ask that question. I always say, what would you say is the most important thing in our culture? And so far, nobody has ever said enlightenment. You know? I'm waiting, but I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. Almost every, I say, what is the most important thing in our culture? And almost everybody goes, money, right? So there seems to be widespread agreement. But in the 9th century in China, this was thought of as very, very important, just as it was more recently in Tibet. You know, people who go to Tibet or Dharamsala have to be impressed by how much the Tibetans have given of themselves to pursue enlightenment. That they're a very poor country, and the exile community in India is very poor, and yet, you know, they've spent an enormous amount of money and effort trying to make it possible for people to wake up. So this is the world that Dahui grew up in. And he went to some local temples, some local public temples, and he was admitted as a student, and he began to practice. He began to practice a little bit of meditation, and he began to study all of the Buddhist sutras. And he got to be he was like a very, very good student. He was admitted to a Soto temple first, and he studied Soto Zen. Very energetically and with great commitment. And by the time he was 21 years old or 22 years old, he had the equivalent of like a magna cum laude degree in Soto studies, basically. He got through all of this training and education, mostly book learning, and wasn't satisfied. He had a real intellectual grasp of Buddhist thinking, enlightenment, and Buddhist culture, and he knew all about the different techniques involved in Soto meditation practices. But he wasn't happy. So after he finished his training at this Soto center, he was 21 years old, and he went to a place called Treasure Peak. It's near the city of Nanjing in Zhangzi province. And he wanted to study with a teacher whose name was Zhang Tongjun. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right. And he was a Rinzai teacher. Zhang Tongjun met Dahui, and when Dahui went in to see Tongzhou, the teacher said, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" So this is a young guy who's gotten like a B.A. in Buddhist studies, magna cum laude. He's been at this Soto training center. If you looked at him, you'd think he really has his act together, right? You know, he has a robe, and it's nicely arranged. He seems to be very alert. He seems to be very together, very in control of himself. He sits on the cushion. His posture is very nice. So he goes in to see the teacher, and the teacher says, "Why are your nostrils boundless today?" Now this is a great question, because it's not about book learning, right? It's not about concepts and philosophy. It's about how do you experience the moment? You know, how do you experience the actual moment? Why are your nostrils boundless today? See, and if you live in a world of concepts and ideas, that makes absolutely no sense. See, that's a great koan right there. Dahui said, "Because I'm here at your temple, Master." So why are your nostrils boundless today? "Because you're such a good teacher. So this is what we call in English brown-nosing the teacher. See? He's brown-nosing the teacher. Tang Shun, or Tang Zhou, either way, said, "You big phony." See, "You big phony." They were training together. Dahui trained with Tang Zhou for a number of years, and one day Dahui came into Dokusan, and Tang Zhou said this to him. He said, "You can talk about Zen very well. You can quote the sayings of former masters and write commentaries on them. You are eloquent in giving sermons and quick with exchanges during interviews. But there is one thing which you still do not know." Ta Hui asked what it was. Tong Zhou said, "What you do not have is awakening. Thus, when I talk with you in the Dokusan room, you have Zen. But as soon as you leave the room, you lose it. When you are awake and attentive, you have Zen. But as soon as you fall asleep, you lose it. If you continue like this, how can you ever resolve birth and death?" And Dawei was very moved by this. Instead of feeling insulted or attacked, his heart was deeply moved, and he said, "You're right. This is precisely my problem." He continued to practice with Tang Zhou. Dawei continued to practice with Tang Zhou and had a number of breakthrough experiences. I've talked about in the past that ordinary people who might have some interest in Zen and who might read a few books on Zen have a very false image of what it means to do Zen practice. And in fact, this koan about the mountain walking on the eastern mountain walks on water is very much about that misconception. The misconception goes like this: you're in ignorance and darkness, and you want to become awake. And so you sit on the cushion and you practice diligently, and then one day you have an enlightenment experience, and you become like you become totally awake, totally awake. It's a little bit like, you know, Western people, when they think of the enlightenment experience, might think of something like a religious epiphany. We say in the Western tradition, like the presence of the divine descends on you, you know. Or it might be like in the Bible, we're told at one point that when John the Baptist is baptizing Jesus, God says, you know, "This is my son. You know, this is the number one person in the universe. He's the real, fully realized human being." So we tend, you know, especially Western people, have this idea that we get from our Western religious tradition that enlightenment is something like that, you know. And it becomes very rarefied, very difficult to achieve, very remote. And we imagine people as like living in total ignorance and total darkness. And then boom, one day there's like an annunciation, and now you're divine. See, this is very common. It's natural that Westerners would think about it this way, because this is sort of how we think of things. This is how our culture has trained us to think of things. But it's really not like that, actually, at all. That's quite a misconception of the whole thing. You know, first of all, it's not true that any human being is ever living in total darkness. That's just not so. You know, people who don't do any zazen at all sometimes have a contact with what we call a Buddha nature or enlightened mind. In fact, it's our human nature. It's our nature as human beings to make contact with enlightened mind, and we do it all the time. So, you know, you might get up in the morning and go outside, and it's, you know, the weather here in New Jersey has just been so great, you have to ask whether it's New Jersey or not, you know. A week ago, I got up on a Saturday morning, and it was 57 degrees, right? No humidity. I was like, what? You know, zero humidity, cool and beautiful. We have a Saturday morning sit every other Saturday down in Minoka Harbor near Toms River. So I have to hit the road around 5:30. So it was about quarter of five, something like that. And I walked outside, and the sun was just coming up, and it was 57 degrees, and there was zero humidity. And as I walked through the grass, I could feel the dew, you know, the cool dew on the grass, the moisture. And it was just so great being alive at that moment, you know. And my mind wasn't full of thoughts. You know, I wasn't thinking about anything. I was just caught up in the moment. And I felt so alive, so connected. You know, humans have these experiences all the time, right? There are times when we don't have these experiences, right? You know, yesterday I was writing at my word processor. I'm working on a project. And I've written this chapter so many times, I have to tell you the truth, I sometimes feel like throwing myself out the window. because it really is, it's chapter 14, and then you can see I'm up to chapter 14, version 14. No, I'm not kidding. You know, I have a chapter 1 has 14 versions. I've written chapter 1 14 times. Right. So I'm up to version 14 of chapter 14. And, you know, I thought I finished it like a month ago. And then I opened it up to reread, and I was totally unhappy with it. I was unhappy with version 13, right? So then I start taking the middle and putting it at the front, and the front goes into the middle, and it's frustrating sometimes. It's not always frustrating. Sometimes writing is a pleasure, but sometimes it's very frustrating. And I don't have to tell you the truth, I don't feel totally in harmony with the process sometimes. So that's a different kind of experience. You know, we can feel angry, frustrated, anxious. We feel like the world is pushing against us and not letting us achieve our goals. You know, it's like there's this huge. So it's like you're pushing one way and the universe is pushing the other way, trying to screw you up. You know, so that's a different mindset. That's, people spend a lot of time in that mindset. When you get on the New Jersey Turnpike, you'll see a lot of people who are in that mindset on the Turnpike, right? So they're screaming and beeping, and you can see the angry faces. Okay. But every once in a while, people fall into enlightened mind. See? And if that didn't happen to people, Zen would make no sense at all. It's because we have those experiences that Zen makes sense. You know, because people drift in here and they think, well, what is this Zen? What is this meditation? You know, and they sit on the cushion and it's like, oh. That is some. It doesn't happen every sit, right? But every once in a while, you get it. You have a sit where you just think, "Oh, this is so wonderful. I feel so calm and so connected. I feel like I'm in the flow. You know, I'm in the flow of things." And you feel that way. You might feel walking outside on a summer morning in your bare feet. It's just like you feel connected with the world. It's like all the barriers are gone. The universe isn't pushing against you. It's like you sort of merge, right? And that is enlightenment. You know, that is enlightenment. So, So, what can happen in Zen practice is that people who have little enlightenment experiences can deepen their experience, deepen their awakening experiences, and they can put awakening at the center of their life. See, that's really what Zen practice is all about. Everybody has these little awakening experiences sort of randomly. And some people know how to control things a little bit. Like some people have a favorite place they go to. You know, so when I was in college, I used to love to backpack, and my friend Larry and I had a place that was called Camp Hoover. It's in the Shenandoah National Park, and we had summer jobs working construction, and on a Friday night, we would get into Larry's car and drive to Camp Hoover. And our construction jobs were really actually very difficult and dirty, and there was a lot of, you know, a lot of really hard work. And when we get to Camp Hoover, you know, it was this beautiful place. There was no building there, actually. It was on a little river in Virginia that was full of rocks, and the water would rush so fast over the rocks it would make a sort of like a humming noise. And it was so beautiful, surrounded by trees. It was usually very cool. And no mosquitoes. It was above the altitude for mosquitoes. So that was like a special place. And when we go there, our minds would become calm, and we felt connected. You know, sometimes you sit on the cushion and you just feel like you're in something. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's like you're in something. It's like you're connected with something. You feel like you're part of something. It's like being in the ocean. When you're in the ocean, you know, you feel something around you. You know, well, when you're in deep mushin, deep samadhi, you feel something around you, you know, and that barrier between yourself and the world begins to dissolve. So some people know how to get there by going to a special place. But you know, it's still sort of like hit and miss. You know, you can go to your special place and it doesn't happen, right? Because maybe you've got too many anxieties, too much stress. So, you know, Zen says, look, it doesn't have to be an accident, right? That's actually our natural state. But we mess ourselves up. We create all of these dream worlds, you know, that are really, they're helpful in some ways, you know. So, like, money is a dream world, right? Actually, money is valueless. It has no value except, like, you know, a piece of paper is worth what the piece of paper is worth, right? You know, $100 bill is just a certain number of cents go into producing that piece of paper. It's the ink, it's the special paper that has the secret watermark so it can't be counterfeited. But mostly it's just a piece of paper with some ink on it, right? It's symbolic, and we give it. Money is really like a game. It's a game we play, right? It allows us to get things done, right? If we play this game, people will actually bring food from California and put it in the shop, right? And we can go and play a game called money and get some of that stuff. Right? And in fact, you know, I was reading this thing the other day that apparently there are whole like virtual worlds with virtual real estate, mm-hmm. And people trade in virtual real estate. And actually, this has like the economy of some of these virtual worlds is like $1 billion or something. It's crazy. But you know, real money isn't any different from that. It's just a dream. So humans create these symbolic systems, these dream worlds, to get things done. But they become kind of like prisons for us. You know, we worry about them. We can't sleep. They make us unhappy. And basically, the Zen idea is, you know, you don't have to live like that. You can clear away the obstacles and get in touch with your natural self. See, so you come and start sitting on the cushion, and it's hit or miss at first, but eventually you're going to start entering samadhi with more and more regularity, and you're going to have more and more of these experiences of being connected with things. It's just going to happen, and eventually it'll happen like every time. And I promise you that. That's absolutely the truth. Sometimes it'll be overwhelmingly beautiful. That's just what this is all about. You know, you get up in the morning and it's like plugging into the universe, right? You sit on your cushion and it's like plugging into the universe. And then just sitting there thinking, oh, this is fantastic, you know, to be plugged into the universe. So that's sort of the Zen idea. It's not the case that people live in ignorance and then all of a sudden, boom, they become divine. Everything is divine. But how we live in the world's another question, see. And Zen people choose to put this experience of connection right at the center of their lives, to make time for it, make a place for it in their lives. So anyway, when Dahui was with his teacher said, you know, you have a lot of book learning, but you don't have a clue about what Zen is really about. And you just don't have a clue. So he starts practicing with Tangzhou, and basically makes a little progress. He starts having what we call kensho experiences, breakthrough experiences. And there's not one. There's like you have an opening, and you have a deep experience of connectedness. And then your habits come back, and you close up. And then you have another deep experience of connectedness, and then your mind closes up again. You know, people are afraid of the world. They've been hurt. They have all kinds of ambitions. So we close up for all kinds of reasons. So Zen training isn't like ignorance, ignorance, and ignorance, boom! The divine descends. It's not like that. It's like you keep encountering your true nature over and over again, and little by little you learn more and more to trust it. And you see more and more that your anxieties are like a feverish dream. They're not real, you know. So anyway, Dahui was making progress with his teacher, Tangzhou. But Tangzhou actually died. He became very ill, and he eventually died. And he told Dahui that, I can't keep being your teacher because I'm in such ill health. You need to go study with Yuan Wu, who in Japanese is called Engo. The Blue Cliff Records, or the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku, is the work of Engo, or Yuan Wu. And so Dahui goes to study with Yuan Wu. And Yuan Wu gives him a koan. And he gives him the koan, the Eastern Mountain Walks on Water. Okay? The Eastern Mountain Walks on Water. So, you know, people don't really understand koans very well either. But koans are really not intellectual puzzles. You know? So a koan is not trying to get you to think through some kind of a paradox or something like that. A koan is asking you to notice something about the moment, and in order to see it, in order to find it, it's right here in the moment, you have to have a lot of practice being in a Buddha mind. Koans are saying there's something in this moment. It's present at all times if you're in a Buddha mind, if you're in awakened mind. So, for example, when Tangzhou said, why are your nostrils boundless today? See, that's really a question about what happens to you when you practice. Maybe some of you have actually experienced boundless nostrils on the cushion. I think some of you have, you know. When you sit on the cushion and you're really focused on your breath or on mu, you may notice that your body awareness changes very dramatically. Sometimes it can feel as though large portions of your body have disappeared, and it can feel like maybe your hands or your face have disappeared, see? And it can feel maybe like you're floating, or you're a round ball and you're expanding. These are all experiences of deep samadhi as it turns into prajna, or enlightened awareness. See? So when you're a deep samadhi, you begin to see the world differently. The boundary between yourself and the world begins to collapse as your dreams disappear. And you begin to be experiencing everything in a unified, spontaneous way. And when this happens, your ordinary body sensations are different. So, you know, people often do have this feeling like I'm floating on the cushion, or I'm out of my body. Some people feel like they slip out of their body, or one person once felt like, he used to tell me that when he was in deep samadhi, he felt like a spider web blowing in the wind, like a very, like there was nothing left but just like the spider webs in his body, and he was just hanging there with the breeze blowing through his empty body. These are all experiences of deep concentration. So, you know, having a, how did he put it, boundless nostrils, that's a deep samadhi experience. So maybe a good answer would have been, I had boundless nostrils this morning on the cushion. Or another good answer might have been, you know, I didn't have boundless nostrils today. I was expanding, I was an expanding ball. Or maybe he might say, my face and hands disappeared, but as for my nostrils, I don't know where they were. See, that would have been a good answer, see? Instead of the brown-nosing answer that he gave, right? Notice he didn't try to figure it out intellectually. He didn't try to treat it like a philosophical question, right? It's pointing to something in the experience of enlightened mind, which we all experience from time to time, right? And which we can spend more and more time with. It's like if you love a person, you want to spend a lot of time with that person. When I met my wife 35 years ago, I don't think she was really crazy about me at first, you know. But I was really crazy about her. And I really could have just spent the whole day hanging around my wife. And indeed, I tried, you know. She wouldn't necessarily go for it, you know what I mean? So she would just sometimes say, listen, I need my space, you know. I love you, but I've got to have some space. But it was like, oh, you know, get up in the morning, hey, how are you? What are we going to do today, you know? What do we do today? It'll be great, you know. And good night, you know. Oh, good morning, hello, you know. I mean, you want to be with that person all the time, right? My wife has a cat who's like that. His name is Isidore. And Isidore loves my wife. And he would be very happy if every day they were just together all day long, right? He sleeps with my wife. When she comes down to eat, he eats, you know. So Isidore loves my wife and he wants to be with her all the time. And I love my wife and I like being with her, but 35 years ago I wanted to be with her every minute of the day. I actually feel that way about my wife still, even though we both need a little space, or we wouldn't still be married, you know. But I feel that way also about enlightened mind, you know what I mean? I love the world when I'm in enlightened mind, and I want to be with it as often as I can. It's like a love story, right? And I when I'm in enlightened mind, I love this world. I love being alive, and I'm even when things aren't going right, you know. And that's sort of like what Zen practice is all about. It's like being in love with the world, being in love with the universe. You just want to be there all the time, see. So Dahui doesn't understand any of this, you know. He thinks enlightenment is about learning ideas, right? And he starts making a little progress, but when he's given a koan, a really serious and difficult koan, the Eastern Mountain Walks on Water, you know, he has to struggle. And people don't necessarily prepared for koan training. You know, even if you agree with everything I've said and you say that sounds great, you know, it's difficult sometimes to penetrate our barriers, to work through all of the obstacles that we've acquired in life. And so koan training, I want to tell you the truth, can be really challenging. You know? I've worked on some koans for, if you have the Mu koan, and I just gave it to you, it might take you 3 or 4 years to really deeply work your way through the koan. Now, you know, the truth is that if you sit on the cushion and you straighten your back and you call mu or u, and at each out breath you go mu, 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 and then periodically you look at your mind. You look at your mind, the way, you know, you can look at your mind and see what's going on in your mind's eye. Perhaps you know what I'm talking about. It's like sometimes when you're sitting on the cushion, if you look in your mind, you can see the movie you saw last night still playing there, right? You know? If you went to see the Simpsons movie, you know, you were probably replaying the Simpsons movie in your head, you know. That's ordinary consciousness. But if you're sitting on the cushion and you're calling mu, and you begin to go into deep mu shin, deep samadhi, and then deep mu shin, you'll notice that when you look in your mind, Homer Simpson in his underwear isn't there, you know. There's nothing there. It's like the TV is off, right? And the screen is blank. It's just like a blank screen. And being able to get to that place is actually very difficult. It takes a lot of practice, years of practice usually, to be able to enter a machine that way and get to that blank mind. If you're interested in answering the mu koan, if you can do that, you've answered the mu koan, right? But it's not much of an answer yet, because you haven't really spent a lot of time with your beloved. Right, you know, you see Mu Xin once a week, but that's not much of a relationship. See, so the we Zen people have a deep relationship with the universe, right? So you want to spend a lot of time with Mu Xin, and so the more you go into that beautiful place, which is the gateway to the Buddhas, right? That into that blankness. At first, it's just blankness, and you think, so what? You know, what's that all about? It's just blank, nothing there. On to the next koan, right? But if you stay there long enough, you begin to notice that it's changing you, right? It's changing you. When I met my wife, I think I was a much more, I'm not a particularly refined person now, but I think I was a much coarser person. And my wife helped me to be more sensitive and less coarse, crude. She's not responsible for the residual crudeness, but she did help the situation. And living with her has been helpful to me. I think it's made me a better person. And living with Mu Xin, I think, has made me less crude, and it has helped me to be a better person. And you don't notice it, but little by little, the more you stay in that blankness, you know, the more it changes you. You become less fearful. You become less angry. You become less self-pitying. You become less vengeful, envious, lustful, etc., etc. You know, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's not like you're in ignorance and then boom. You know, it's like you just keep coming back and little bit, you change. You become tender-hearted. You know, hard-hearted, and you keep going into mu, and you become tender-hearted. And if you become tender-hearted long enough, you become a really different person. And there's fewer barriers in yourself. And if there's fewer barriers in yourself, you can begin to experience in a more dramatic way that beautiful life energy, which is our true nature, right? It's like we're water in a rushing river of energy. We feel so tired and worn out all the time because we're blocking. We're so afraid. You know, we're so blocked. And if you become a little tender-hearted and you take away some of those barriers, you suddenly realize you're like awash in a sea of life energy. It's very rejuvenating, and it's just like heaven, you know. Answering the koan, answering any koan, is kind of a tricky business, because if you can get to the state that the koan is indicating, if you can find the state that the koan is indicating, You know, that's step number one, and that takes some groping. But then the question is, how deeply can you engage with that state? So if somebody said to me, why are your nostrils infinite this morning, you know, I'd know what that's about. I'd say, I've been in samadhi many times, you know, or a Zen answer might be, today my head was infinite, see, or today my nostrils disappear. That would be a good answer. You know, how many times has that happened to you? If it's happened once, okay, but if it's happened 1,000 times, it really changes you, you know. You develop a kind of trust in life that maybe ordinarily we wouldn't have. Answering the koan has maybe two parts. One is finding what the koan is pointing to. And then how deeply can you make yourself one with it by removing the obstacles? You know. So this koan is the Eastern Mountain Walks on Water. And Dahui, remember, Dahui's been practicing maybe for 10 years, see. And guess how many times he went into Dokusan and had his answers rejected? 49 times, okay? So Americans have a hard time with that. Let me say, you know, we all come through this educational system, and, you know, if you do your job, you're supposed to get an A, right? Isn't that how it is? If you study hard, you try, you're supposed to get at least a B, right? You're not supposed to get a C, and you're not supposed to get an F, right? I'm a teacher, and sometimes I'll give people grades like a C or a B, and they'll come in and see me and say, but I worked so hard, this is so unfair. You know, maybe if you're a teacher someday, you'll hear that too, you know? And you have to say, well, it's not just about work, you know. So the thing is, with koans, you can work really hard, and you might not be able to find what the koan is pointing to, or you can find it, but you aren't really deeply engaging with it. Yeah. And that's really hard for Americans to take, because we're used to like doing the job and getting the good grade, and I hope you won't think of koan practice as like being graded. It's not like you come in and you get a grade. It's an opportunity to like deepen your experience of fundamental reality. And sometimes when you're blocked, when you face your obstacles, and you face big obstacles, you can have a great breakthrough, you know? So actually, there are people who are pretty good at answering koans, but they don't really have a deep experience of enlightened mind, believe it or not. And that's true. Sometimes being blocked, not being able to answer your koan, gives you the chance to really have a big, if you have a big blockage, you're really blocked in some way, and you work your way through it, you can have a big encounter with fundamental reality. So that's kind of what's happening with Dahui, you know, 49 times. Well, we have sessions 5 times a year, okay? And usually people on a 5-day session come in 4 times in Dokusan. And on a 7-day session, they come in 6 times. So we do 2 7 days, that would be 12 Dokusans, and we do 3 5 days, that would be, in a year, you have a chance for 24 Dokusans, right? So it took him 49. So let's say he spent 2 years on this koan. 2 years of going into the teacher and being told, nope, sorry, sorry, no, sorry, no, wrong, no, no, no. So I won't kid you, you know, that's part of Zen practice too, is not losing confidence in life in the face of failure or in the face of not getting it, you know? And that's very important. Most people have a very false view of Zen practice. You know, we all want to go into the Dokusan room and the teacher says, oh, that's it, congratulations, here's your next, you know. I used to be in the Boy Scouts, and in the Boy Scouts we used to have a sash and we put our merit badges, right? So if you picked up newspapers for half a year, you got a community service merit badge, right? If you went on a hike, a number of hikes, you got the hiking merit. Pretty soon you have this big, you know, belt. And we can think that way about Zen practice, but really that's not what Zen practice is about. It's not about the getting a belt, it's about getting rid of your belt, right? Getting rid of that kind of a self-image, right? So, you know, if you're frustrated long enough, you develop a really deep mind, right? Deep mind. Sometimes we come in and we sit on the cushion and everything is going our way, right? You know, you get enough sleep and you come in here on a Saturday morning and you sit on the cushion and for some reason you pick the right cushion. You know, there is a whole, there's a whole art to getting the right cushion, you know? I'm sure you've noticed that, you know? Sometimes you can go through the cushions and think, damn, you know, somebody's got my cushion, you know, the one I like to sit on. You know, this one's too hard, this one's too soft, this one's just right, right. So you get on the right cushion, and then you have to get on the cushion the right way, right? You know, because if you're off center, you know, that hip, your hip will hang down, and then after about 20 minutes it starts to hurt, and then that pulls your foot on your thigh, you know, and so on, and it snowballs, right? So after an hour of sitting, it's really killing you, right? So you know, but one day, you know, you come in, it's a beautiful day, you're rested, you sit on the cushion, you get the right cushion, no aches and pains, you go deeply into it, and this is heaven, right? We all have that experience. But that's a very shallow experience of fundamental nature, of enlightened mind, in my opinion. You know, sometimes you get on the cushion and it's not the right cushion. You know, and your hip is killing you, and your leg starts to bother you, and your back starts to bother you, and you didn't get enough sleep last night, and you sit there and think, I hate this. You know, I just hate this. And you sit there and think, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And if you go to Sesshin, sooner or later, you're going to have a day where you're sitting there going, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. But then, you know, something can happen. You know, all of a sudden, all of that just clears away. It's like there's this big clearing. And you're in that place. You know, you're in it. And it's deep. It's deep. You know, it's like playing in the baby pool. You know, and then suddenly going and diving into the ocean. You know, it's like you suddenly are in that place. You know where you are. You've been there before, but this time it's deep. It's like indestructible, imperturbable calm, imperturbable connection with the universe. See, and that's a deeper experience. You know. That's really what Zen is all about. You know, you can if you're content in life with, you know, the occasional glimpses of enlightenment. That's wonderful. But there are some people, you know, who just aren't content with that. You know, they want a deeper experience, and you know, for those people, Zen practice is not really about having like one enlightenment experience. It's about spending 50 or 60 years in enlightened mind, in deep samadhi. And it's like soaking in, marinating yourself in enlightenment. You know, sometimes you can take vegetables that taste pretty good, and you can just soak them in something like a salt solution. And you soak them day one, and they're okay. Day two, they get more tender. Day three, it's like, oh, delicious, right? Well, just soak them for 50 years, right? And very tender, you know, very beautiful life. This is what Zen is all about. You know, Americans are so, I'm an American, so, you know, don't get me wrong. But let's face it, we're very, there are people who really do come in to do Zen and they think, well, how long is this going to take? You know? 2 years? 3 years? See, even actually Da Hui, he even had a timetable. Da Hui was discouraged, and when he went to study with Engo, with Yuan Wu, he actually said, "I'm going to give this 9 years, and if it doesn't work out, I'm going into real estate or something like that." That's it, really. That's a part of the story. Da Hui, it's like 9 years or I'm out of here. You know, I'm going to sell real estate. I'm going to put my time into something else. There are people who think that. 2 years, 3 years, how long? You know, and I usually say, well, it takes about 10 years to complete your formal training. And then some people never come back, right? But I'm going to tell you the truth, even 10 years, it's not what it's about, you know. It's about living your life with this experience of enlightened mind at the heart of your life, right? It's like marinating yourself in enlightenment for 50 or 60 years. See? And maybe if you're having a tough sit, you think, oh my God, 60 years of this, you know. But every once in a while, you know, you'll hit it. And the more you hit it, the easier it is to get back there, provided that you live a certain way, right? I mean, frankly, if you are not nice to people, it's going to affect your consciousness, you know. You can't go around being mean to people and insulting and aggressive and expect to sit on the cushion and have a nice time. You know, that those habits carry over. If you have substance abuse problems, you should do something to resolve those. You know, if you make an effort to help people in your life, usually that carries over into your sitting practice also. So, you know, If you keep practicing, and you try to be a compassionate person, it's a beautiful life, beautiful world, and there is a kind of imperturbable, awakened mind, and this is what practice is all about. You know, you can be practicing for 20 years, and then one day something knocks you right on your butt. You know, you find yourself getting mad, you find yourself being frightened. And you think, oh, I've been practicing for 20 years and there's still something that bothers me, you know? So you get back on the cushion and you work through that obstacle and then it's on to the next obstacle. But if you spend 50 years working through your obstacles, you know, that's a wonderful way to live, in my opinion. You know, Buddhas are people who have worked through all their obstacles. Bodhisattvas are people who have worked through a lot of obstacles. It's a very rewarding way to live, in my opinion. It's like heaven. So Da Hui didn't answer his koan 49 times, but then he did answer it. Master Yuan Wu ascended the high seat in the lecture hall, and he said, once a monk asked Yunmen this question, where do all the Buddhas come from? Yunmen answered, the East Mountain walks over the water. But if I were he, I would have given a different answer. Where do all the Buddhas come from? As the fragrant breeze comes from the south, a slight coolness naturally stirs in the palace pavilion. And Da Hui said, when I heard my teacher say this, all of a sudden there was no before and no after. Time stopped. There was no disturbance in my mind, and I remained in a state of utter calm. This is like his Daikensho. Anyway, we're out of time. Let me just say one more thing. Even after he had his Daikensho, his teacher kept giving him koans because he wanted him to steep in enlightened mind. Right? So, if you have a timetable, you're going to be disappointed. You know. But they're really, time is just another game we've made up, you know, really and truly. And when you're in deep samadhi, deep mushin, time disappears, and everything is just perfect, just as it is in this moment, right? So, you need to own a wristwatch, but don't take it too seriously. And please keep practicing. Please keep practicing.